This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
This is commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston.
Welcome to the New Capital Show. Good morning. On today, October 4th, 2007, the year is almost over. Pleasure to be with you this morning here at the New Capital Show. www.newcapitalshow.com. www.newcapitalshow.com. I want to welcome all listeners in the Houston area, broadcasting from 90.1, the studios of 90.1 KPFT FM, and on the web, iTunes, Podcast Alley, many of the podcast directories. I've started to get all kinds of email from all over the country, people who listen to the show. So welcome to all of you who are listening outside of the Houston area. We are part of the Pacifica Radio Network, of course, most well known for Democracy Now!, but also for our radio stations in different cities in the country, and also for those who pick up our programming. I welcome all listeners who would like to join the mailing list of the show. You can do that at the website, newcapitalshow.com. We're just, you know, we're building an army of people who are like-minded. And if you find yourself like-minded in common cause with some of the issues that we take up, then I would love to have you in our database so that we can communicate with you as and when the time is good, whether when we're having events or just something comes up that's on my mind, or some action that would be good to take. It'd be great to have you as part of our database. I want to thank Galen Godwin, who appeared last week on the show. Galen Godwin, Zen priest and teacher. Great response to that. A lot of people very interested in how they can and how you can come to find a place to learn to meditate. I think it's very, very important that more and more people take up this activity. It's very important in our busy lives to take a moment to find a place, a quiet place, to sit down and just center and to just be quiet. You'd be surprised at the incredible benefits that it would bring to your life. And if you missed that show and you want to get a replay of it, you can listen to it, of course, on the website. It's all there and available for you. Some people have asked again for how to get in contact with Houston Zen Center. That is HoustonZen.org. But there are many places. Whether you live in Houston, whether you live in New York, it's almost any place. Zen centers, meditation centers are springing up all over this country as people discover the benefits of both meditation and also of some of the benefits of Eastern spiritual practices as well, and how they can be integrated into Western spiritual practices. We'll be taking your calls a bit later in the show. 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT is the number. It's going to be an open mic day, and would love to hear from you to talk about issues that are on your mind, but let me just put a few of them out there. I've been watching Ken Burns's extravaganza documentary on the war. It's called The War. I don't know if any of you have been watching it. If you have and you've got some comments, I'd like to hear from you this morning. Again, 713-526-5738. I've been a student of the Second World War on occasion in my life, and so for me this was something that I needed to watch. I know that there's been controversy about the program from a couple of perspectives. First, there was the detailing of his omission of the involvement of Latino soldiers, U.S. Latino soldiers in the war, and that he had to basically staple on a chapter to the documentary, which he did, and I think that aired last night. I saw it last night, so it did air last night here in Houston. And also just the very American-centric, almost totally American-centric focus of this documentary. Now, I don't fault him for that. He is an American documentarian. His subjects deal with American history, and they deal with it from an American perspective. So I don't fault that. And of course, Ken Burns didn't get to where he is by making a poor product. He makes an excellent product. And I always find that there are things that I'm able to learn from his documentaries, not just from a factual standpoint, but also the way that he is able to get individuals who were there to talk about their experiences, often in very profound, very moving ways. And I think that the war certainly continues that tradition of Burns's work. And I think that the documentary also very clearly portrays what the United States faced in terms of strategic and in terms of an enemy. I always like to go back to John Keegan's book, The Second World War, that was published, I don't know, a decade ago or more. And the point that he makes at the very outset of the book is that we can talk about the war happened because of Hitler, the war happened because of German bitterness over the settlement of the First World War, and therefore the First World War and the Second World War are inevitably stapled together. Of course, this is something that is commonly taught. And I think that Keegan makes, at the outset of his book, a very, very important point. He says that the truth of 20th century European civilization was that the world it dominated was pregnant with war. The enormous wealth, energy, and population increase released by Europe's industrial revolution in the 19th century had transformed the world. It had created productive and exploitative industries, larger by far than any at which the intellectual fathers of the industrial revolution had guessed. It linked the productive regions of the world with a network of communications, roads, railways, shipping lanes, telegraph, and telephone cables. It generated riches to increase tenfold the population of historic cities and to plant farmers and graziers on millions of acres, which had never felt the bite of the plow before. It had built infrastructure, schools, universities, libraries, laboratories, churches, missions. But above all, Keegan points out, and in dramatic and menacing counterpoint to the century's works of hope and promise, it had created armies, the largest and potentially most destructive instruments of war the world had ever seen. Keegan points out that the Europe that existed in the early 20th century and which continued to exist through the Second World War was a European world, at the very least, dominated by armies, in which, as he puts it, every man was a soldier. Every man was a soldier. If we think back to the nature of warfare, going back to feudal times, warfare was something that was practiced by noblemen, and that was it. Maybe a few, you know, mercenary peasants. But generally, warfare was not something that was conducted by the entire nation. And in fact, the entire nation was not a mobilizing concept. People fought for king, not for nation. And of course, that changed. We have become, for better and often for worse, a world that sees itself in national terms. And as Keegan points out, what came about in the 20th century were enormous armies fighting for nations, identifying with nations, soldiers who identified themselves as nationals, existing within borders. And when you combine the technological advances in the 19th century, which brought about killing power of weapons, and the ability to produce through industrial production enormous amounts of these armaments, and then you then put them in the hands of enormous numbers of people, you got world wars. And I think that Burns portrays that the United States was in fact behind in this dynamic. It's hard to think of now. It's hard to think of now that our country, this country, the United States, has been the country that has fought more often than any other country since the Second World War. That, of course, is a product of this country having emerged victorious in the Second World War and, relatively speaking, unscathed. But Burns does an effective job of taking the viewer back to 1939, when the United States was largely, you want to call it unprepared? The U.S. made different choices at that time. It invested its capital differently. And so, when the armies of Europe and the armies of Japan broke loose upon the world, the U.S. was relatively unprepared for that, and it took several years for the U.S. to bring its own production of war material up to speed and to put it into the hands of large numbers of American citizens. At that point, watching the war, you could say, okay, I can understand how we can get from that picture in American history. And of course, as I say, Burns is portraying American history. I can understand how we can get from that point, an unmobilized United States mobilizing to go to war against a world which was increasingly being taken over by what? By militaristic governments. There were three things: militaristic, nationalistic, and they were racist. Governments of Germany, Japan, to a lesser extent, Italy, had come to practice an ultra-nationalistic and certainly an ultra-militaristic. All of the leaders of these three countries saw the world through military eyes. Hitler, basically. What was he? He was an ex-soldier. Mussolini, an ex-soldier. Tojo and the Japanese leaders, soldiers. These were governments of advanced industrial nations generating large amounts of armaments and putting them in the hands of almost all the citizenry, and the leaders themselves were soldiers. And you do get that contrast with the United States, led by Franklin Roosevelt, not primarily a soldier. And as I say, I think that you can get from these points to saying, as an American, I see the U.S. playing a beneficial role, a good role in that war. For us, it was a good war. It was the good fight. And as Burns puts it, a necessary war. That was the title of the first chapter of the documentary that aired last night, A Necessary War. This, of course, plays off against the war in which this country currently finds itself, in Iraq, which I think the majority of people in this country have come to the conclusion was an unnecessary war. And watching Burns's war in the agony documentary, in the agony that it portrays, one wonders, how could any leader launch an unnecessary war? And of course, I've seen much commentary as people watch Burns's documentary and they're prompted to think about our current leadership, wondering, how did we get from there to here? I think that Burns ultimately, and I've seen the entire documentary, I don't think I'm spoiling it if I say that I think that Burns misses an excellent opportunity. Ken Burns knows that his documentaries are going to be viewed by millions and millions of people. And he knows that every single inclusion that he puts in is going to be noted, and exclusions as well. And in my opinion, Ken Burns missed an extraordinary opportunity to very meaningfully point out to the American viewer of today that not all, as practiced by American armies, but especially by American air forces in the Second World War, were good or necessary. specifically the bombing of German cities, and especially, and moreover, the bombing of Japanese cities in the Second World War, is conducted by the United States Air Force and also by the British Air Force. In my opinion, and from the study that I've done, by that point, this country had come to adopt some of the egregious, murderous, and illegal policies of its enemies. Burns almost gets there. He points out the episodes of the firebombings of Germany and the firebombings of Japan, but that's about all he shows. It goes very quickly. He glosses over it. He doesn't gloss over it. He doesn't go into any depth. We are told many times about the difficulties of infantrymen, American infantrymen, facing incredibly staunch opposition in amphibious landings in Europe, on islands. And of course, as we know, it is from last week's show, it is important to empathize, it is important to feel the experience of all living beings. And I'm not discounting that at all. But it seems to me that Burns missed an excellent opportunity to bring home chapters, a chapter in American history, which too many Americans do not sufficiently appreciate, which is that large mass killing of civilians, women, children, elderly, non-combatants, people who were not carrying weapons, many of them totally innocent, too young to have formed opinions about anything, and they were killed in the millions, at least a million in Japan, perhaps 500,000 in Germany. What are your thoughts on this? If you've seen the show, do you concur, do you not concur? Is it the same thing? Did the United States stoop to the methods of the enemy by that point in the war? 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. And why is this important? Why is it important? Well, you know, one of the corporate sponsors of the war at the end of the show comes on. I can't remember which one it was. It says, you know, it's got this nice emotional music and fields being portrayed, and they basically make the comment that, you know, we've got to learn from our history so we can have a better future. And I think that that's, you know, I think that's exactly right. I think that there are many reasons why an appreciation of American behavior through what was called strategic bombing is important. It's important that we view World War II not as something where the United States fought only the good war and a necessary war, but a war where the United States itself, when faced with certain conditions, such as the need to, what was perceived as the need to invade the Japanese homeland islands, decided to take what it thought was the most expedient way to lessen damage to our troops, which was to bomb civilians. 713-526-5738. A couple of other things I want to turn to, then we'll get to your calls. George Bush held a summit on global warming, climate change. I think it was last week. And, of course, it got a bunch of press. This was held at the State Department. Amy Goodman focused on it for one of the episodes of Democracy Now! Last week. Got a lot of attention in the mass media. This was a summit that was held at the State Department a few days after a more inclusive, call it worldwide, summit on the issue was held at the United Nations, which George Bush himself elected not to attend. Thankfully, we got a lot of press about that. We saw a lot of press about that, and a lot of questioning as to why Bush didn't decide to show up. But Bush's conclusion and the Bush administration's conclusion at the conference at the State Department was that it would be best if nations undertook voluntary measures, that we should not have any kind of global coordination to meet this challenge. I mean, what's new? You know, the leader of this country never sees any reason for people to get together across the world and come to mutually agreed upon and binding ways to do things together. It's voluntary. You want to do it? Okay, fine. You don't want to do it? Okay. So, you know, you got to choose. And the press reacted like there was something new going on. You know, Bush had a new conference and these new ideas were discussed and they're going to be voluntary. They're going to be voluntary measures that nations can be taking. I want you to think back to when George Bush came into office in 2001. What was he saying about global warming and climate change at that time? Nothing different. The same thing. No, we need to have voluntary measures that were taken. There has been no change in his approach to climate change. No change in climate change. Let me say that again. No change in climate change from this administration. Staggering. Staggering that people continue to, and the media continues to portray these conferences or these pronouncements that they make as anything other than what they are, which is a utter continuation of the same thing that he has been saying since he came into office. That is to say, no change. No change. Now, we cannot say the same thing for evangelical Christians in this country. Page 1, September 28th of the Wall Street Journal. Heated debate. Split over global warming widens among evangelicals. Texas Christians cite conflicting scripture, staying on mission. Susie Painter, director of public policy arm of Texas's biggest group of Baptist churches, traveled to Central Texas this year to talk to a local preacher about a pressing moral, biblical, and theological issue. She wanted to discuss coal. Christians have a biblical mandate to be good stewards of God's creation, Ms. Painter says. She told the Reverend Frank Brown, pastor of the Belmead First Baptist Church here in the county where President Bush has his ranch. And the article goes on to talk about the Republican Party beginning to schism over this issue, climate change. Those who read the Bible and understand their Lord's description of the beauty of the planet, the need to take care of the planet, understand that to fail to do so is to go against those teachings. More bad news for Republicans. Republicans grow skeptical on free trade. Again, page 1 of the Wall Street Journal, October 4th. You want to read about the falling apart of the Republican Party? The best place to do it, you know, maybe it's Mother Jones, but I'll tell you, the best place to do it is the Wall Street Journal. I don't want to say best. One of the best. John Harwood reports on October 4th, by a nearly 2-to-1 margin, Republican voters believe free trade is bad for the U.S. economy. A shift in opinion that mirrors Democratic views and suggests trade deals could face high hurdles under a new president. The sign of broadening resistance to globalization came in a new Wall Street Journal NBC News poll that showed a fraying of Republican Party orthodoxy on the economy. My friends, 2-to-1 in the Republican Party. Staggering. Does Bush know what's going on? Probably not. But I promise you Republicans in the know do. That's why they're in the know. There's a ground shifting going on in this country. You feel it? 2-to-1, Republican voters believe free trade is bad. Why? Who's voted for the Republican Party? Rank-and-file Americans have been voting for the Republican Party. People who've believed that the Republican Party would deliver to them benefits of free trade. And what's happening? They're seeing that it doesn't. Now, my friends, I am for free trade. But I'm also for fair trade. Free and fair trade. And we will not have a free trade system in this world that works until labor standards, environmental standards, product standards, capital standards of all kinds are consistent. Where agreements have been made between countries on a multilateral basis and the rules are fair and consistent. And we don't have that now. That system has benefited the very wealthy in this country and other countries, but it has not benefited the rank and file. And shockingly, 6 in 10 Republicans, or those who support the party, now agree. It doesn't stop there. GOP is losing grip on core business vote. Wall Street Journal, October 2nd. This was the most emailed article that day. Deficit hawks defect as social issues prevail. The party left me. The Republican Party, known since the late 19th century as the party of business, is losing its lock on that title. New evidence suggests a potentially historic shift in the Republican Party's identity, what strategists call its brand. The votes of many disgruntled fiscal conservatives and other lapsed Republicans are now up for grabs. It's what I've been saying for 5 years since I started doing this show. Liberals are the party of fiscal conservatism. It is we who understand the full and the true costs of projects. It is we who say, you want to undertake a project? Fine. We respect you for doing that. We support you for doing that. We applaud you for doing that. We believe in progress. We believe in advancement. We just want you to calculate the full costs of your project when you undertake it. If it will have environmental costs, we ask, we demand that you include those in your calculation of your return, and that those costs be remediated. This is amazing. Such misgivings do not necessarily translate into long-term gains for Democrats, however. They may. We'll see. One man, Richard Cooper, of Winnetka, Illinois, this is from this article in the Wall Street Journal, a 67-year-old investor and former chairman of Weight Watchers, hasn't just switched parties. He is helping Senator Hillary Clinton's campaign. He was an early Reaganite. He unsuccessfully sought the Republican nomination for Illinois governor in 1976. He says he's been alienated in recent years by Republican policies across the board. A leader of the International Responsibility to Protect Project for Global Action Against Humanitarian Crises, he opposes Bush foreign policies. The father of a daughter with lupus, he wants funding for stem cell research, which anti-abortion Republicans oppose. As for fiscal policy, Mr. Cooper contends, he says, Democrats are the new conservatives. Republicans, he says, are still talking about tax cuts. It was one thing when Ronald Reagan was doing it and the top income tax rate was about 80%. Mr. Cooper says, now taxes are reasonable. So what if I have to pay 5% more in taxes? Shift your gaze, dear listener, to the state of Iowa, where Fred Thompson has entered the Republican race for president and leads in many national polls. The article yesterday in the New York Times was out describing Mr. Thompson as utterly somnambulant and putting to sleep those who come to his rallies. An utterly uninspiring sight. Fred Thompson. And what did Mr. Thompson say in his article?
Fred Thompson said, we need to quit doing things in America that aren't working and just keep doing things that work, like tax cuts.
The leader of many national polls of the Republican Party race for the nomination is pushing policies, ideologies, and ideas that are 30 years old almost and were enacted successfully 30 years ago. What is Cooper saying? He's saying, folks, tax rates back when Reagan pushed for tax rates were 80%. Okay, you got an argument. They were too high then. I mean, you know, certain people may say, no, 80% is where they need to be, but, you know, at least you've got an argument. We're here in 2007. The long-term capital gains tax rate is 15%. For many, the highest tax rate is 35%. Many never see that rate. 25%? How is it that Fred Thompson is going out and arguing for tax cuts? Bush, one of the signal accomplishments of his administration, his tax cuts. And of course, where has it gotten us? It has gotten us to Stephen Roach, who writes in Save the Day. His recent op-ed in the New York Times, September 25th, Stephen Roach, who is the chairman of Morgan Stanley Asia and one of the best-known public economists in this country. He says currencies are first and foremost relative prices. In essence, they are measures of the intrinsic value of one economy versus another. Basically, what Roach is saying is that currencies, in a way, are the stock value of a country. Stock price value. He says, on that basis, the world has had no compunction in writing down the value of the United States over the past several years. The dollar relative to the currencies of most of America's trading partners is off about 20% from its early 2002 peak. Recently, it has hit new lows against the euro and a high-flying Canadian currency. I can remember going to Montreal a few years ago, several years ago, and I mean, it was so cheap. I thought, I need to buy a house in Montreal for, you know, $50,000 on the waterfront. I didn't do it. I should have done it. It's going to cost a lot more now. Sadly, none of this is surprising, writes Stephen Roach, because Americans have not been saving in sufficient amounts. The United States must import surplus savings from abroad in order to grow, and it has to run record balance of payments and trade deficits in order to attract that foreign capital. Roach goes on and talks about the fact that we may be reaching a tipping point. He says, sadly, the endgame could be considerably more treacherous for the U.S. than it was 7 years ago. We've gone through consumer buying binges. Consumption expenditures currently account for a record 72% of the gross domestic product. This buying binge has been increasingly supported by housing and lending bubbles, yet home prices are now headed lower. Political winds are blowing against the dollar. In Washington, China bashing is the bipartisan sport du jour. New legislation is likely to impose trade sanctions on China unless it makes a major adjustment in its currency. Roach goes on to say, why worry about a weaker dollar? The United States imported $2.2 trillion of goods and services in 2006. A sharp drop in the dollar makes those items considerably more expensive, the functional equivalent of a tax hike on consumers. It could also stoke fears of inflation. So far, the dollar's weakness has not been a big deal. And that is true because other countries and their companies have kept prices low for their products. That may be about to change. Relative to the rest of the world, the United States looks painfully subprime. So does its currency. My friends, it's very important that you look at your own personal finances and you see that you have enough savings. I meet with people every day who come in to see me, and we take a look and we see, okay, you're going to retire. You want to stop working. Look, we're living longer. If you're going to retire and then live 20, 30 years and be supported by your savings, it takes, you know what, at least $50,000 generally to live in some meaningfully middle-class type of way between rents and food, prices going up, gasoline, you want to take a vacation, just living fairly modestly. Call it $50,000. Do the numbers. If you're going to live 20 years, you're not going to work at all, that's $1 million that you have to have in savings. Ernesto, can we take a quick break? We have anything we can... We'll do it. We'll be right back on the New Capital Show. We'll take your call. 713-526-5738. Back in a moment. And we're back again. www.newcapitalshow.com is the website. First up today is going to be Fred. Fred, you've been holding a long time. Welcome.
I'll be real quick. My first point is that Neville Chamberlain, you know, everybody says that he was an appeaser and not very, you know, not too smart. Actually, he was supported by General Motors, Ford, and all the industrialists because their biggest fear was the Bolshevik communist revolution in Russia, where the Japanese troops and U.S. troops, French troops, and English troops were fighting the Bolsheviks and were not able to defeat them. That's why Chamberlain supported Hitler. But I want to get away from that. If people want to talk about that, what I want to talk about is when I was 4 years old, I was in Manila. In 1945, the Americans bombed Manila and killed 100,000 people, burned the city down completely. There were dead people everywhere. The whole city was on fire. And my stepfather was an American soldier who married my mother in 1946, explained to me that the Japanese were mowing down the Filipinos. I didn't see that. I was 4 years old, but I asked other Filipinos who was in Manila, did they see the Japanese mowing down Filipinos? They said, no, they never saw it. That's all I want to say.
Fred, are you there?
Yeah.
Fred, what do you want Americans to know about the conduct of the U.S. Air Force?
The Russians did the same thing to Warsaw because there were Germans there, and that was all over the news. When I came here in 1952, you know, my stepfather brought us back to the U.S., and they talk about it. They talk about even the bombing of Dresden, how the British killed 100,000 Germans for no reason. But they never talk about the Americans bombing Manila.
Fred, thanks for your call. I don't know what I can add to what Fred has said. He's given you his experience, and of course that's among the most powerful things that Ken Burns does, and it's for that reason that I really regret that he didn't take the opportunity in the war to give the experience of those who were bombed, who did bombing, and to really bring home to the American people that by the end of the Second World War, it was not a good war. And many of the things that were being done were not necessary. There have been many military studies since that have shown that, in fact, what was called strategic bombing had absolutely no impact on the war. Didn't change it, didn't cause civilian populations to rebel against their leaders. It didn't achieve any of its goals. It was a slaughter. Hopefully we've learned some since then, and yet when you read the papers about Iraq, you know, we see many, many, many civilians that have been killed in Iraq. And it makes us question whether we've learned or not. Ken Burns will be appearing here in Houston. I think it's November 13th. I hope you all will take the opportunity to go. It's being put on by the Progressive Forum. And ask this question of Mr. Burns. If we get enough of you asking the question, maybe the question will be asked. Randall Morton runs a good show at the forum, but the questions he screens. You write your question down, and then Randall chooses it or doesn't choose it. I'd like for you all to go, and I'd like you to ask Ken Burns, why, Mr. Burns, did you not devote significant time to explaining to viewers strategic bombing and the death of civilians? Certainly that's part of American history. Let's keep the conversation going. Neil is next. Neil, welcome.
Hi, Leo. The program provides us with a view of a lot of stuff that was censored during the war. And I'm the son of an American GI rifleman in the Pacific Theater. And when I told him that that it was so disturbing to see the account of the guys looting the soldier. I mean, you're watching them shooting down guys, you know, in cold blood, and while the guy is still, you know, in his death throes, they're rifling through his pockets.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, we all did that. It was, he said, I cannot tell you why, but I know that we are raised to abhor killing. You have to train people to become killers.
Yep.
He was, as a matter of fact, he ended up in Hiroshima 2 weeks after we bombed it. And once the Japanese were comfortable with the Americans, he was getting questions from his interpreter. You sure you guys have, why did you have to bomb us?
Mm-hmm.
And I know from my father's point of view, this makes him very angry. It probably, you could devote a whole show to that. But you know what? I feel about that show, about the war, this documentary, that, our fathers, I don't know about your father, but most, I would say, seeing as they're the senior citizens of today that are dying off the most quickly, that generation, I think in some ways we want to examine that good war and compare it to this and how maybe it's not as different as we thought.
Neil, thanks for the call.
Yeah.
I think Ken Burns beautifully portrays the experiences of American soldiers, and they bring home very much men who are now old men, older men, how by the end of it they it was not a good war. They were experiencing things that in many cases are remain unspeakable for them. Several say, I can't tell you what I saw. I can't tell you what was done. I just can't even say it. And this radio network, Pacifica Network, was founded by those who believe in the idea that there's no such thing as a good war. And of course, Burns calls it a necessary war, not a good war. But many still call it a good war. And of course, a woman on the documentary, Ms. Phillips, who's incredibly eloquent and very poised, very dignified, says the atomic bomb was the greatest thing. She says, well, you'll never tell us that it wasn't. We were facing an invasion of the Japanese mainland. And of course, my question is always, well, if you were demanding unconditional surrender from the Japanese, then yes, you were going to have to invade. And by that point, there was no room left for anything in the United States' position or belief in its position, other than it had to be unconditional surrender. But it may be that the Japanese would have been willing to surrender under different conditions, and that would have allowed us to claim victory short of dropping bombs on women and defenseless children. Next up, let's take Don. Don, welcome to the New Capital Show.
Hello.
Yes, you're on.
Yeah, first of all, I want to say thanks for that first caller who called in. What a brave man to sort of give his perspective there.
Yep.
Another thing about the war, you know, it is reminiscent of what we're doing now in Iraq and really Afghanistan. It's all the same. When we move to that war culture, it's going to take some time for us to move back into the social culture, which is what I think that most people who would listen to your program would think would be a good move for the United States.
But Don, isn't there an argument to be made that says that the world that was not under Axis domination faced increasingly, absent a mobilization of counterforce, faced an increasingly shrinking world of free people? I believe that. And what is so disturbing to me about the strategic bombing, the bombing, I'm not even going to call it, dignify it by giving it the name strategic, because there was no strategy to it. It was just terror bombing.
Yeah.
It was carpet bombing of Japan and German cities. What upsets me so much is it prevents me, as a reader of American history, from saying our participation in this war was upright to the end. Meaning, they blew it. The Air Force generals, with the tacit agreement of the political leaders, blew it. They blew it. They had it in their hands. They had infantry in Europe that was crossing and defeating German armies at the point of battle. They were meeting German armies, and they were defeating them in battle. And that's what was winning the war. And in the case of Japan, the U.S. Navy...
I don't know. I mean, we could talk about that for...
Okay, Don, thanks. In the Pacific, U.S. Navy and Marines were meeting Japanese soldiers and defeating them on islands. There was no need for strategic bombing. Okay, let's take the next call. Let's take Rob on line 4. Hey, Rob.
Hey, I just wanted to throw out something quickly about how you were kind of talking about that a lot of the more despicable strategies that the U.S. used in World War II might have been adapted from, you know, the fascist and imperialist powers. And, you know, I think that it goes, you know, it's not 1945 wasn't the first time that the U.S. used really violent tactics against other people.
No.
And, you know, I mean, the foundation of the country was based on its desire to expand westward into North America and, you know, the conquest of Texas, the conquest of northern Mexico.
The mid-19th century, the manifest destiny of the 19th century when Native Americans were killed.
Yeah, for sure, as well as invading
for their land.
The Philippines in 1898 and Puerto Rico and Cuba, you know. So, I mean, you know, I don't think you were saying this, but definitely wanted to say that, you know, 1945 wasn't the beginning of you know, military abuses by the United States.
Yes. Thank you, Rob.
Okay. Thank you.
This is the New Capital Show, www.newcapitalshow.com, coming to you from KPFT 90.1. We're talking about Ken Burns' documentary, The War, today. And I had a feeling it would be a very popular topic, and indeed it is. Next up is Joe. Yes, Joe.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good.
It's a good show. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I'm Latino, and I wanted to make a point about that. But first, real quick, I'd like to make a comment about what you said about the strategic bombing. I couldn't be more in agreement with you. What we did in Dresden and other areas in war, just completely obliterating it, wasn't necessary. And you're so right about what you say about how it really takes the integrity and the dignity from our history. And it needs to be really, really reviewed so that we can try to make a change for the future towards that.
Do you agree, Joe? It hasn't yet really. It's been touched on. For example, if you look at I think what is Errol Morris's movie, The Fog of War, in which Robert McNamara is interviewed, and he was on the planning of these targets.
What Kissinger did to the Cambodians.
Yeah.
But it's just. And then damaging our history. They say that leaving Iraq will cause what we did in Cambodia. That's not true. Mm-hmm. What Kissinger did to Cambodia was what caused all that misery.
Right, that's right.
Anyway, get back to the point. I'm a Latino. And thank you for all that, because you're right. It really needs to be touched on and expounded upon big time. Mm-hmm. But as far as the Latinos and how some have remonstrated that they needed to be mentioned, I can't really agree with that so much. I mean, we're all Americans, and we all know that there was our fathers, you know, our forefathers who were Latino, but there were also Native Americans. There were also, you know, the African Americans. We were all Americans, and something like that, I think, could go into a different story.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's my take on that. As far as that goes, I appreciate Ken Burns' story,
yep.
But
nope.
I also appreciate even more the things that you're talking about.
Joe, thanks for the call.
Bye.
Next up here is, let's take Rick. Rick, welcome.
The thing about Ken Burns that you have to remember is that when he covers a subject that's very broad, that's lengthy, like the Second World War, that he doesn't touch it. Any great deal on nuances or things that people would perceive as nuances.
Well, Rick, I disagree. I mean, there are many in-depth interviews with character portrayals of people who are prominently featured, and their experiences are prominently described and discussed. And so that's the window through which Burns allows more detailed stories to be told. And they're often very detailed, down to, you know, I saw the man's head blown off and his guts blew on me, and on and on. And all I'm saying is, certainly Ken Burns could have found somebody to testify to the effects and the incidents of mass murder through bombing that occurred at the hands of the U.S. Air Force in the Second World War. Surely he could have found somebody. He didn't go out of his way to do it.
Well, he didn't talk to anybody from any other side. He talked to Americans. He didn't even talk to British people, if you remember correctly. But when he talked about the strategic bombing, in particular that ball bearing factory in Germany, they talked to the pilots and they said, yeah, we had these new sites and we were supposed to be able to drop a bomb into a pickle barrel, but we couldn't hit, you know,
yep.
a city.
That's
we
right.
We were bombing, you know, everywhere. We
That's
were dropping bombs in lakes and
That's right.
stuff like that.
That's right.
And he touched on how they lost 600 guys, 10
right.
bombers in the first attempt. They went right back, lost another 10.
Yeah.
And all they did is burnt up the city.
Yeah.
And they thought, well, maybe that'll make the people turn. But it didn't. They
right.
just went back to work and said, well, we got to get to work. And they cranked out more ball bearings, more ships, more everything, because it strengthened their resolve. So he does touch on it, but he doesn't go into any great length as far as, you know, talking to people who were firebombed. But he didn't talk to British. He didn't talk
nope.
to French or Canadians.
That's right.
Well, like you said, he's an American documentarian.
Yep.
And he doesn't spend a lot of time. Just like, you know, I've heard gripes that from the conspiracy people that, well, he didn't talk about how we knew Pearl Harbor was coming and allowed it so we could enter the war.
Rick, thanks for the call, as always. Great to hear from you. Rick makes a great point, and it, you know, I agree with the point. And I said it at the outset of the show. He's an American documentarian, but what Burns is guilty of, and this is the criticism that I think appeared in perhaps the New Yorker or the New York Times, is that this documentary is only from the American perspective. And what was the American perspective on bombing cities in Germany and Japan and perhaps elsewhere? It was from a gun sight, exactly as Rick says. It was dropping a small object and watching it explode in the distance. And my point is simply, it was sufficiently massive of a crime that it bore, somehow, in all Burns's documentary brilliance, bringing out the effects of that far more personally for the viewer, so that those Americans watching could finally have the breakthrough that is required to understand that by the end of this war, it was not a good war, and what was being conducted was not necessary. Next up, let's take Maurice. Maurice, welcome.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My father survived the Bataan Death March. My uncle Johnny was a bombardier in the Air Force and bombed all of Europe, but most specifically, of course, Germany. And I'm a Vietnam veteran. I feel like these wars are all about money, including the good war. Hitler wanted to take it all, and we weren't going to let him have his more than his share. And he used all his reasons for going into war and his hatred for Jews and so forth.
Yeah.
But all of these wars seem to be caused all about money. It's a great way to transfer wealth from the working class people into the coffers of those who are already filthy, rotten rich.
Yes.
Okay. I think Ken Burns' documentary was good.
Yes.
I agree with you that he should have touched more on the people who were affected by the bombing, like my Japanese neighbor whose family was wiped out in Nagasaki.
And this is someone who lives next to you now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He lives next door to me now. He's a good neighbor. He's a kind person.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's been a hard worker all his life. You know, he says he still bears the shame of what his country did in the war. And I tell him, look, you are my age. I was born in 1941. You were born in 1940. I said, what did we have to do with anything? We weren't making policies. We didn't know anything about all this stuff. You're not responsible for that.
Yeah.
And so forth. But my Uncle Johnny came back after blitz bombing all of Germany for over a year and drank himself to death.
Maurice, thanks for the call. It's a pleasure to hear from you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You know, he used the phrase bearing the shame, and I think that that's what I'm talking about here. I feel that I try to bear the shame of the atomic bombings. And I understand that there are those like Ms. Phillips on Burns' documentary who say, bear the shame. We love the atomic bomb. It was the greatest invention since bubblegum, you know. You don't understand. We were losing our sons. I do understand. But the U.S. faced a choice, and the choice should have been either we're going to send our army in infantry by infantry to take that place and avoid civilian casualties, or we have to demand something other than unconditional surrender. We may not get everything we want, but we can't drop bombs on children and women and non-combatants in order to get unconditional surrender. That's not a trade-off that we're willing, that we should make as a country with the moral upper hand. And I think that, you know, we even young Americans, need to learn how to bear some of that shame. If not bear that shame, then to understand at least that there is some shame. And we agree Burns touched on this issue. I agree, he touched it. But I want him to do more than touch it. You know, Ken Burns needs to do more than just touch strategic bombing in the Second World War by the American Air Force. He needs to do more than just touch it. And I'm hoping that you all, here in Houston at least, who can do so, will go to see him speak on November 13th, and that you will put this question over and over and over on the note cards that Randall Morton will collect, and that Randall Morton will ask Ken Burns, why did you not do more than just touch on strategic bombing, which was the U.S. end of atrocity in the Second World War? We've got time for one more call, and let's take a new caller. Somebody I haven't heard from before. Maybe, let's see, Ronald. Ronald, you get the last call today.
Well, thank you. I needed the time. Look, I sent you an email, but the main concern was that a man by the name of Rourke, if you do a Google search and the word DU, you'll find out the atrocities that we're doing now in Iraq and Afghanistan. Literally 380-some tons of depleted uranium is dumped on Iraq and Afghanistan. Another one that you'll be shocked to hear about is on his website also, that the nuclear plants in Europe had registered high levels of uranium in the atmosphere around their plants. And when they started doing research on it to find out where it was, their plants were not leaking. And they started looking into it further, and they found out because the winds and stuff in Europe, that 7 to 8 days before each one of their readings at high levels in Europe, shock and awe and Fallujah occurring.
Ronald, thank you for the call. Yes, we need to know what's going on now. No question about it. Today's show has been devoted to trying to talk about what went on 50, 60 years ago. But certainly, I agree. We must know what's going on now. That does it, just about does it for another edition of the New Capital Show. It has been a pleasure being with you today. Again, Ken Burns will be here on November 13th. We can talk about this show again. It's going to be airing all throughout this fall. So if you want to bring it up again next week or some other week, we can certainly talk about it. It's a subject that I think is endlessly of interest when the entire world literally went bananas. www.newcapitalshow.com is our website. You can hear rebroadcasts of our shows. You can send email to me there. You can register yourself in our database so that we are able to communicate with you and continue to build this army of people. Again, I want to thank all of you who voted in the Houston Press Readers Poll. New Capital Show won Best Local Talk Show here in Houston, voted for by readers of the Houston Press. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to be with you. Back next week. Take care.
Isha Vasyam presents a spectacular production that includes visually impaired and blind dancers from India, a ballet on Shiva as the Lord of Elements, featuring different dance styles of India. All this is taking place on Friday, October 12th, 2007 at 8 p.m. at Stafford Center Performing Arts Theater, located on Cash Road. We'll see you on Friday, October 12th. For more information, please call 713-876-5400. Repeating, 713-876-5400. This is KPFT, Houston.
Charles Brown, the late great pianist, has been heralded as one of the most influential blues artists of our time. Join us on Saturday, November 3rd, as the City of Tech City honors the life and music of blues pioneer Charles Brown. The musical celebration kicks off at 2 p.m. as Austin's LZ Love takes the stage. Next up, Ezra Charles and the Works from Houston, followed by the legendary Texas Johnny Brown and the Quality Blues Band. And last but not least, alligator recording artist and blues music award winner, the long, tall Marsha Ball. Arts and crafts, classic and art cars, concessions, children's area, free admission and parking. That's the Charles Brown Day of Remembrance Blues Festival on Saturday, November 3rd, from 2 to 10 p.m. in Nestor Park, Texas City. Take I-45.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.